Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Yale University has announced it will install a new 24/7 emergency contraceptive vending machine on campus. Said Harvard students, wasn't Yale already Plan B?
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth chats with journalist Mehdi Hasan. Plus, just for this podcast, Mehdi continues the conversation backstage at Studio 8G. But first, a closer look.
President Trump is a threat to democracy, but as Republicans in Wisconsin and Michigan have made clear this week, he's not alone. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. We know Trump thinks he's above the law. That much is clear in the Russia investigation. Trump keeps interfering in that investigation by dangling the possibility of pardons for his aides or praising associates who refuse to cooperate, like his ex-campaign chairman Paul Manafort, or his former advisor, Roger Stone.
I feel very badly for Paul Manafort and his wonderful family. Justice took a 12-year-old tax case and, among other things, applied tremendous pressure on him. And unlike Michael Cohen, he refused to break and make up stories in order to get a deal. Such respect for a brave man.
I will never testify against Trump. This statement was recently made by Roger Stone, essentially stating that he will not be forced by a rogue and out-of-control prosecutor to make up lies and stories about President Trump. Nice to know that some people still have guts.
Well, he is right about Stone's guts. This is a real photo of his actual outfit from the inauguration. It takes real guts to go out in public dressed like a Coke dealer from a Charles Dickens novel. I mean, look at him. He looks like he's about to carjack Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. And for months, Trump has been openly floating the possibility of pardoning Manafort, even as special counsel Robert Mueller tries to get Manafort to cooperate in the investigation. Trump even praised Manafort publicly in an interview on Fox News and complained that Mueller was trying to get him and other Trump associates to flip.
This whole thing about flipping, they call it. I know all about flipping. For 30, 40 years, I've been watching flippers. They flip on whoever the next highest one is. It's called flipping, and it almost ought to be illegal.
You know, Trump may say he's against flipping, but if he was ever arrested, he would flip more than a dad working the grill at a cookout. Here is our scientific computer simulation of how Donald Trump would react if he was indicted. It was Don Jr., it was Eric, it was Ivanka, it was Melania, it was Tiffany. Take Tiffany, you don't want me, you want Tiffany, you want Tiffany! And Trump did it again last week in an interview with the New York Post where he confirmed again that he's considering pardoning Manafort.
During an Oval Office interview, President Trump told the New York Post he has not ruled out a pardon for former campaign chairman Paul Manafort. Quote, it was never discussed, but I wouldn't take it off the table. Why would I take it off the table, the president said.
Here's my question. Why are you doing interviews with the New York Post? Trump so desperately wishes he was the mayor of New York and not the president. Then all he'd have to do is talk to the Post, show up to ribbon cuttings, and have sandwiches named after him at delis. Make sure you order the Donald Trump. It's a turkey sandwich, but the turkey is ham because I'm a liar.
Trump was already
facing possible obstruction of justice charges before, but his comments praising Manafort and Stone and dangling the possibility of a pardon raise a new question. Is he also guilty of witness tampering? That's the opinion of at least one prominent Republican lawyer, George Conway, the husband of Kellyanne Conway, who's been an outspoken critic of Trump. George Conway retweeted Trump's tweet about Roger Stone and added this, file under 18 U.S.C. subsections 1503, 1512. Which are the statutes of witness tampering and obstruction of justice. The best part of that move is that by tweeting out the actual laws, he made sure Trump will have no idea what he's talking about. 18 U.S.C. 1503, what the language is this? You know what? I'm just going to click translate tweet. Trump has been dangling the prospect of a pardon and hoping Manafort and Stone will refuse to cooperate with Mueller. If you're Mueller, the question is, how do you respond to that? And we found out on Tuesday when he filed a sentencing memo for ex-National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and recommended that Flynn get no jail time because he's cooperated with multiple investigations. And yet, Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, tried to argue that that was actually good news for Trump. Although I really can't follow his logic or his syntax. Here's a text message that Rudy Giuliani, the president's lawyer, sent to a political reporter after the Flynn news broke. Wow, big crime for a special whatever, maybe a group of angry, bitter Hillary supporters who are justifying themselves by the goal justifies the mean, over the top and ethical behavior. What? Does Giuliani's iPhone have auto incorrect? I have no idea what that means. It's like when your grandpa uses the voice-to-text feature while he's driving. Wow, big crime for special whatever. Watch where you're going, you idiot. Oh, that was my exit. Of course, Rudy isn't just bad with phones. He's also terrible at Twitter. Last week, he tweeted, Mueller filed an indictment just as the president left for G20. In July, he indicted the Russians, who will never come here, just before he left for Helsinki. But because Giuliani forgot to put a space between the period and in, he accidentally created a link. So someone bought that link for $5, and now, when you click on it, you get this message. You burnt. So basically, you burnt. But in reality, we burnt because the same grandpa vampire who wrote that tweet was named cybersecurity advisor by Trump in 2017, which is like putting the Hamburglar in charge of security at the ground beef factory. So the story that's unfolding here is simple. Trump broke election laws, lied about it, and then tried to obstruct the investigation of those lies. He's a threat to democracy and the rule of law. But he's not alone, as we're seeing this week in states like Wisconsin and Michigan. After the GOP lost elections in those states, Republicans in Wisconsin and Michigan responded with pushes to limit the power of Democrats who won those offices. The GOP's power grab in Wisconsin is so shameless that hundreds of protesters have streamed into the Capitol to vent their anger. And they just happened to be there on the same day that the outgoing Republican governor, Scott Walker, was hosting the annual tree lighting ceremony, which produced this very odd scene.
Protesters swarmed the Capitol for the second day straight.
The governor of the state of Wisconsin, Scott Walker.
Merry Christmas. Demonstrators booed Governor Walker at a Christmas tree lighting ceremony.
It's so weird to watch someone say Merry Christmas to a bunch of people booing him. He's like a dad who got his kids a graphing calculator when what they really wanted was an Xbox. Hey, kids, let's do some math. You want to show me what you're working on? Republicans are trying to get away with this as we speak, but protesters have courageously challenged them in public hearings. Here's one Wisconsin resident who showed up to a public hearing and stood up to Republicans while also trying to maintain her Wisconsin politeness.
Greetings. My name is Jan Frieswijk, and I'm speaking mainly to the Republicans here because I believe there is something you don't understand, and that is that you lost. You lost. You lost. Problem is you can't let go of power, and you're stealing. I've looked at this panel for 6 hours. You can look at us. You don't trust us. You think you're better. You think you're more intelligent. Well, you're not. You're not letting the voters choose. Look at me.
Oh, you done it now. Jan is angry. in Wisconsin. And that's a big deal because in Wisconsin, the highest threat level is Angry Jan. Jan even put on her yelling turtleneck. Republicans in Michigan are also trying to preemptively take power away from the incoming governor and the incoming attorney general, Dana Nessel. And if you're wondering if Nessel is the kind of attorney who's going to sit quietly for that sort of thing, allow me to direct you to this very real campaign ad she aired last year.
If the last few weeks has taught us anything, it's that we need more women in positions of power, not less. So, when you're choosing Michigan's next attorney general, ask yourself this. Who can you trust most not to show you their penis in a professional setting? Is it the candidate who doesn't have a penis? I'd say so.
And she was right, but unfortunately, even Republicans don't take out their penises. They can still act like a bunch of dicks. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, hey, Republicans won the state legislature fair and square, so they get to pass the laws if they want. But Republicans actually won the state legislature in Wisconsin despite getting fewer votes because gerrymandering in Wisconsin is insane.
Wisconsin Democrats won a majority of votes for the state assembly, state legislature. They won by a margin of 8 points. But that's where Wisconsin Democrats hit a snag. Because of the way Republicans in Wisconsin have gerrymandered the districts in the state, even though the Democrats got more votes in the assembly, they got a ton more. They won by 8 points in terms of votes for assembly seats, but still, Republicans won most of the seats.
Republicans won 45% of the vote and 64% of the seats. And look, I'm not saying Dana Nessel was right about Republicans and penises, but some of those districts look very strange. Trump might be the most prominent example of the GOP's lawlessness, but he's not alone. We have a president who thinks he's above the law and Republicans who think they're above elections. A democracy can't function if you change the rules after the game just because...
You lost. You lost. You lost.
You're a hero, Jan! This has been A Closer Look. Our guest is a columnist for The Intercept and the host of its Deconstructed podcast. He also hosts Upfront on Al Jazeera English. Please welcome to the show, Mehdi Hasan. I'm so happy to have you here. I want
to
start
to
by showing a clip for those who are here who maybe aren't familiar with your work. You interviewed, what is he, you said, in charge
of... Trump campaign advisor.
Yes, in charge of re-election, I guess. And he... You interviewed him in a way that many have said is this is the template for talking to people within the Trump sphere. And I just want to show it real quick. Let's take a look.
He said during the campaign that there's 6 to 7 steel facilities that are going to be opened up. There are no. U.S. Steel has not announced any facilities. Why did he say they've announced new facilities? That's a lie, isn't it?
No, it isn't, because there are a lot of companies opening up. There are steel facilities that are going to be opening up, or I think
Stephen, that's not what he said. I know it's difficult for you. I know you want to try and defend him. Let me read the quote to you. U.S. Steel just announced that they're building 6 new steel mills. That's a very specific claim. U.S. Steel have not announced 6 new steel mills. They have said they have not announced 6 new steel mills. There's no evidence of 6 new steel mills. He just made it up.
The American people are doing well.
Steve Rogers lied. Well, and the president can be a liar. There's no contradiction between those two statements.
So, well done. Do you think... I don't want to put you inside his head, but do you think he was unexpected for how prepared you were? What do you think was happening there?
I think so. And to be fair to Steve Rogers, that's his name, he's a very nice guy and good sport about it. But he does Fox News most of his time. And if he does do other cable news channels, it's the same problem everywhere. Unfortunately, interviewers on US television tend to have limited time, limited resources, and just want to keep moving things along. And when I interview people, I try not to move along. I don't want to move on. I want to stick to it and try and get an answer. That's my job. Right.
Well, I think one of the things you did that was so nice is, again, there's so much happening in the Trump campaign that I think oftentimes as an interviewer, you're caught with, I want to hit 11 different topics. You stayed on one thing.
I was like, the lies.
Yeah.
Let's go with the lies.
Yeah.
There's 6,500 of them.
Right.
I'll pick 3 or 4.
But, you know, and that makes it, I think they are hoping and waiting for you to move on to the next thing.
There's a bit in the clip, which you don't see if you watch the interview. He actually says to me at the end, he goes, let's just move on. Ask me another question. I'm not going to do that. And the problem is, they look, most people would move on because it's uneasy. It's not easy to go up and just keep asking someone the same question. I don't like doing it. You have to relentlessly keep asking the same question, keep asking for answers, not moving on, getting in people's face. That's rude, right? Seth, you don't want to be rude to your guests.
Of course not.
It's socially awkward and we're taught not to be like that. Although I'm British, I'm rude and socially awkward to begin with, so I may have an advantage over some Americans.
But what are the differences that you've seen in how the UK press and the US press deals with power?
It's a very good question, and I think you guys... definitely there's a cultural issue. You guys had your revolution, War of Independence, you kicked the Brits out, and yet, weirdly, you're more deferential to power, I would argue, than we are. You know, the president walks into the East Room of the White House, and the White House press corps stands up, which I find British journalists, for all their sins, would not stand up. If the Prime Minister comes into the room, they'd be lucky to even pay attention sometimes. You guys have this thing where it's kind of Banana Republic-esque, where you allow your politicians to have their job titles for life. Uh-huh. So do you remember in 2012, it was Governor Romney, Governor Romney, governor of what? His backyard.
Yeah.
He hadn't been governor of Massachusetts for five years. Secretary Albright, Secretary Clinton, Mayor Giuliani, Ambassador Bolton. If anyone here lost their job, they wouldn't get to keep the title the next day after they've... Why do you do that? Why do you do that with your politicians? It's weird. I just don't get it.
You have, I think one, you know, obviously this has been an issue based on what happened this week. George H.W. Bush passed away, and you wrote an article for The Intercept, basically a full accounting of his record. And one of your criticisms was when politicians pass away in the United States, the coverage is sort of glowing. It's all their best qualities and none of the things they did wrong. Do you think that is unique to Americans talking about politicians, or is it just the way Americans talk about anyone who passes away?
I don't think it's unique to Americans. I know when Margaret Thatcher died in the UK, the same thing happened, a lot of hagiography. I do think you have this deference to power. Your president, to be fair, is not just the head of government, they're the head of state, so it's kind of like the Queen and the Prime Minister rolled into one. I get it. And, you know, if somebody dies, it's sad. You know, watching George Bush Jr. today cry as he gave that tribute, I'm no fan of George W. Bush, but to watch a son cry for his father, that's, of course, very touching, heartbreaking. But he wasn't just a father to George Bush. He was also the most powerful man in the world for 4 years. A lot of Iraqis died on his watch. A lot of Panamanians died on his watch. A lot of black people saw the racist ad campaign, Willie Horton, that he ran in 1988. A lot of people died in the AIDS crisis that he didn't really pay much attention to, in the war on drugs that he ramped up. And I think it's worth recounting all of their lives. Journalism is supposed to be the first draft of history. Well, we need to give it to you full, warts and all. You can't just say respect for the dead. Yes, we should respect the dead and respect a dead president. But also we should respect facts, history, what actually happened. And I think that's... Otherwise, the country's screwed.
Obviously, it seems like the element that is really unique to this is how much journalists are saying he was the opposite of our current president. And they are talking about how civil he was and... You know, you bring up, and I recommend people read the article, both the things he did that he was very good at and moments that people would say were uncivil. Do you think people are actually drawing a distinction between Donald Trump is like this and George H.W. Bush was like this? Or do you think they want George H.W. Bush to have been that civil? Whether or not he was, they want to believe in the idea that we had a thing.
And in many ways, he was. And in many ways, I mean, look... If he had died under Barack Obama, I think we'd be having a different discussion. I think dying during a Trump presidency means we all look at him and say, why can't George H.W. Bush be president? He wasn't nuts. He wasn't a crazy racist in the same way that Trump is. He's not a narcissist. He wasn't a draft dodger. He served his country. He didn't have bone spurs. Fair enough. So we do look at him in that way. Yeah. We want to believe that he's something, you know, better than Trump. Trump makes George Bush look good. Trump makes everyone look good.
He makes everyone
right?
look good.
But we can't. We can't lower the... I don't think we should lower the bar. It's the presidency of the United States. We need to take it seriously. I don't think we should lower the bar so much that we say, oh, he's not Bush. He's not Trump, therefore he's great. Or, you know, today, oh, Trump went to a funeral and didn't tweet or insult anyone or drool, therefore he's acting presidential. Suddenly we're here. If that's the criteria, I have a six-year-old daughter at home. She's ready for the Oval Office. And she has an American birth certificate.
Well, there you go. Well, we would love to meet her.
We'll bring her back.
She sounds fantastic. Last thing, you talked to General Michael Flynn. You interviewed him a few times. What was your take on interacting with him? Are you surprised where we are now?
Not really. General Michael Flynn, I interviewed him a couple of times during the campaign. Very nice guy, very friendly. We got along really well, which is weird because he thinks Islam is evil and we should all be afraid of Muslims. Minor issues. But we got along well. And I didn't think he was the sharpest tool in the box. I didn't think he would last long in government, but 24 days is a very short period.
Yep.
Still...
It's a double Scaramucci, though.
It's a double Scaramucci in measurement terms. What was interesting is I interviewed him, and it was a very tough interview, and I kind of pinned him down, and I did all these tough questions. And at the end, I said, General Flynn, this was in the summer of 2016, will you take a job from Donald Trump? Will you serve as his defense secretary or national security advisor? And he kind of laughed uncomfortably. He said, ha, not after this conversation. And I remember thinking just the other day, I was like, if only he'd stuck to that, he wouldn't be a criminal today and in massive debt.
Yeah.
But, you know, we tried to help him out.
You did your best, yeah. Hey, thanks so much for being here. I really appreciate
it. Thanks so much for having me on.
I like watching you do what you do. Betty Hoffman, everybody.
Hi, this is Henry from Late Night. Here with Mehdi Hasan. How are you?
I'm good. I just had a great time with Seth.
You were excellent.
Thank you so much.
I mean, you do TV. Your show's weekly. You've got two weekly shows.
Yeah, but serious shows. Though.
Serious news shows. So I'm sure that was
a
welcome change of pace.
Different, yes. Outside of my comfort zone.
So you started as a reporter in England. You're from England. How did reporting there differ from your job here in the States?
Well, for a start, we didn't have Donald Trump. We've never had Donald Trump. No country in the world has had a Donald Trump.
No, we didn't.
Oh, you didn't either. Although I arrived in 2015 in the US to work as a journalist, the month or two before he came down the escalator with his whole Mexicans are rapists.
Wow.
And I remember thinking, this is going to be weird for a year or two of campaigning, and then we'll be back to a Clinton presidency.
Right.
And here I am 3 years later, having done nothing else but kind of sleep, eat, talk, walk Trump. He's taken over my life as a journalist.
Is that frustrating to you? Do you wish you could kind of cover more topics and issues, but you just get everyone gets pulled into the Trump show?
Yeah, it's very frustrating for me. I feel bad because the journalism I do for Al Jazeera in particular is global journalism, and there's a lot of people around the world are saying to me, why are you tweeting about Trump? What about what's going on in Kashmir? What about what's going on in in Central African Republic? And I'll be like, yeah, I know, but this stuff, unless you're here in the US and you know this from doing this show every day, it sucks you in. You can't get away from it. And you know, a lot of it is very important. There's the President of the United States saying or doing racist things, launching crazy wars, maybe colluding with foreign powers, inciting racist attacks at home. It's hard to take your eye off the ball.
What do your friends in England, what do they ask you about your job covering Trump here?
They're all like, what are you doing there? You're crazy. Come on. I'm a Muslim immigrant in Trump's America. I'm a Muslim, I'm an immigrant, and I'm a journalist. Three categories Trump loathes. They're like, come back to England. And then I say to them, well, how's England? How's the UK? How's Brexit? And they're like, oh, it's here. Uh-huh. And I'm like, oh, well, it's not great over there. Maybe we should all just move to Canada. I mean, the serious point is this. As bad as Trump is, in 2020, you hope people can vote him out. With Brexit, that's forever.
You've talked about the different kind of cultural forces that have created different results, but are very similar between the UK and Trump. What has it been like covering both of those kind of simultaneously?
It's been fascinating to see it happening. It's been depressing as someone who's from a community that's on the receiving end of a lot of anti-immigrant animus, a lot of Islamophobia on both sides of the Atlantic. Seeing it everywhere is deeply scary and depressing. When you look across the countries, France, Canada, America, Britain, attacks up everywhere, racism, bigotry up everywhere. What's really frustrating is trying to get people to understand that this is a global movement, that this far-right, revanchist, nationalist, white supremacist, populist movement, it is connected. Look at what's happening in Brazil. I do not think Bolsonaro would have won in Brazil, this horrible autocrat who makes Trump look like a moderate, had it not been for the Trump election and Brexit. These all feed into each other.
What's happened in Brazil is a major, frightening story, but that's just not covered that much in the States. Do you enjoy being in a network like Al Jazeera that has more of a national audience or international audience?
Very much so. And I'm lucky enough that when I do my TV show, it's on Al Jazeera English, which is a global channel. And when I write my articles for The Intercept, it's very much foreign policy oriented. They're very interested in what's going on in the world, US foreign policy. So I do get to talk about what's going on in the Middle East. When I'm not doing Trump stuff, I get to talk about what's going on in the Middle East or what's going on in India or Pakistan or what's going on in Europe with Brexit. I think that's really important because, yes, you cannot understand what's going on in America unless you take the global picture. I know for a lot of Americans, foreign policy is some weird alien thing. What's happening around the world is, you know, something, someone else's business. But I think actually with Trump now, I think Americans are starting to wake up and realize, A, how long is it going to take us to recover our reputation after this Trump presidency? It took you 8 years of Obama to get kind of George W. Bush out of the system. I suspect it will take you about 25 years to get Trump out of the system.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the damage, I mean, look at the State Department, not just even in terms of reputation, but our tools for diplomacy have been depleted under this president.
But see, something even more basic than that. He goes to the UN and they laugh at him. Literally, the world was, you know the phrase, the world is laughing at him. No, they were literally, the world was laughing. And then he comes out and he goes, they were laughing with me. Right. Classic guy on the end of a, individual. No, they weren't laughing. They were laughing with me, which is, of course, BS. The world is laughing at
him. Of course, we all saw it.
I don't believe your lying eyes, Henry.
That's exactly right.
That's the Trump message.
This brings up a question I wanted to ask you. As a viewer, it can be incredibly frustrating to watch people interview Trump or his surrogates. Even your fantastic interview with Stephen Rogers, you brought up all these facts, you presented all these facts. It was very clear to an audience why he was wrong. But at no point is he going to say,
yeah,
oh, you got me, I'm wrong. As a journalist who puts in the work to those interviews, how frustrating or kind of hopeless, how frustrating is it? Do you feel hopeless when you're doing these interviews?
Sometimes it can be frustrating when the message doesn't get through, when the facts are on your side and people still don't believe you or don't pay attention. You know, after the Trump election, after Brexit, I was just like, you know, this is absurd. People will vote for anything. They'll believe anything. I might as well just jack in journalism and go be accountant with great respect to all accountants. Course, but, you know, what is the point of doing what I'm doing if some people aren't listening? But you have to remind yourself that is a minority of people. There's a minority of Americans who have cut themselves off from facts, figures, empirical evidence. Most people still, I would argue, care about facts. And we saw the midterm results showing people do care about policies, healthcare. It can work. Mm-hmm. But yes, it's frustrating. But I would say sometimes there's value in asking the question. Even if the interviewee is not going to concede anything, the audience need to see the interviewer holding them to account. Sometimes, you know, truth is worth fighting for, even if you know, even if you don't get the great admission.
Well, I'm glad you are fighting for it.
Appreciate
again, it was so wonderful to be introduced to you through that fantastic interview. I'm so excited to follow your work. It's been just really wonderful to have you.
You're so kind. Thanks for having me on the show. It was a great experience.
Oh, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. It was great to have you.
Seth is an amazing host.
He is great. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Once upon a beat! Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.